Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, December 11th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 120. I'm Austin Walker. It is December. It's cold. It was snowing over the weekend. Joining me today, also from parts cold and unknown, except I actually know where they are, Patrick Klepek.
Hello. It's supposed to snow here.
Oh, wow. Really?
No signs yet.
Okay. And Rob Zachney, are you snowbound? Do you have snow in your life right now?
It's definitely, like, we had our first real snow of the year here in Boston. It wasn't anything like they got in, like, Buffalo during the
right,
football game.
Right,
but there's definitely, like, some very pretty snow on the ground.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, that's what you kind of want. That's, like, the dream, right? Is, like, you get all of the joy of opening up the door in the morning and seeing, like, seeing and smelling the crisp snow on the ground, but none of the, like, needing to break your back shoveling snow or die driving over ice. Like, that's the bad part, and if you can avoid that stuff, then I think you're in a good place.
See, snow for me becomes a walking, picking up my dog and trying to find a yellow snow so I can set my dog next to it so that they will pee on the yellow snow. So I can take my dog back. My dog hates the winter. Has never. We've tried putting boots on her feet to try and make it easy. Takes the boots off. Nothing.
Y'all live in Chicago. That's a place that's cold. Like, you get a lot of snow. Was that not, like, a consideration for Pixel?
We've had this dog. With dog had was introduced in our lives in San Francisco back when this was not a problem. We put this upon her, and she doesn't like us. So she.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, our old dogs. They grew up around, like, we had them since they were puppies in Northwest Indiana. Like, they loved snow. Like, they were snow. Like, the first time it started snowing, the dogs instantly, like, reverted back to being puppies and just, like, run around and play in the snow like crazy. Right. It was great. Then a few years ago, we adopted a relative's Labrador who sort of came of age in Tennessee. And that dog hates snow, but more than that, has a deep suspicion of it. Like, it goes beyond, like, an aversion to snow, and is, like, that dog approaches snow like it expects it. Any moment, like, a monster is, like, a Yeti is going to, like, rear out of it and try to eat it. Like,
and you know what? It might, Rob. We don't know. We don't know the mysteries of the snow. We do our best to survive. And I think maybe that dog is being cautious and smart.
In 2017, like, fucking anything can happen, all right? Like, Steven Spielberg is directing a Ready Player One movie.
Oh,
so,
fuck.
Like,
God damn it.
Oh, man. I can't wait to drink from the holy grail of pop culture.
I watched that trailer. A lot of people linked me that trailer, that new trailer this week, because Gundam is in it, the original Gundam is in it. And it's just like, nothing could make me want to see that movie less than them trying to pander specifically to me. Yeah, are you
Tracer
fucking kidding me?
Tracer couldn't make it even less appealing?
Chucky and Freddy Krueger, they're putting every reference in for all of us. It's like, nah, like, you put a little Chucky does not mean I want to see this film.
This film is not where I'm at. Oh man, it's so much to think about Steven Spielberg as the director of this because one, because there are just Spielberg movies referenced in this, which is this weird recursive curse. It's like a recursive curse that is just killing me. Like it is one of my least favorite things to do is to reference my own material. And so it's so hard for me to see Spielberg doing it. And then two, it's just like, how they've chosen to promote the film has undercut any faith I had that Spielberg was going to be able to turn this thing around into something. Like, that was always the thing that, Patrick, you told me this. A lot of people told me this. I was like, well, okay, but it's Spielberg. Maybe Spielberg can find the
maybe there's like a human, you know, like story, yes, in there. Like, I have not read the book. My only understanding of the book is through other people's hatred of the book.
I don't think it's a very good book, is what I'll say.
It makes sense for a teaser trailer to like play up all of those like homages, yeah, and like the you know, like it's kind of cool. Oh, the Iron Giant, like that's like a kind of a small reference for people that like are fans of animation and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But like the second trailer where you think, okay, like here's where we're gonna set up like what this movie is about. And instead, I mean, it did. It was like, oh, it's a search for an Easter egg, which immediately made me groan. I was just like, come on. Like, really? Like, and nothing – I mean, I'll probably see it when it shows up inevitably on Netflix, but it's a bummer. We were talking about this before in the pre-show, like before we started recording, about trying to figure out, like, the inflection point where I think, like, sarcastically on Twitter, I said that Spielberg had lost it. And when I around the time that this first trailer came out, and what my more nuanced version of that was that, like – Spielberg trying to make these like the most Spielbergian movies like of the E.T. Sort of era, I think died post Jurassic Park, in that Steven Spielberg doesn't know how to use computer graphics, and that Jurassic Park constrained him in a way that like played to his strengths, which were like a great way of framing computer graphics and practical effects. Jurassic Park, while it has some aging shots because like the shots that are pure computer graphics, like just by the
don't look
the,
great.
Yeah. Just because the nature of technology, like that, that it's gonna hurt any shot that relies too much on that. But like large parts of that film work, and even the compositions and the way they set up both those work really well because of the constraints. And like Spielberg post constraints, like when he works in digital worlds, I think he has a lot of trouble. Like even movies like the BFG. Which came out last year, which is not a bad movie by any stretch, like is undercut by the amount of computer graphics in a way that I just think he has trouble working within, like differently than perhaps a director that grows up in computer graphics
with those, yeah.
But I mean, I think we should not underestimate the fact that, like, I do not think that modern like computer generated effects are generating a great, like, very many iconic tableaus at all, right? Like, I do not think this generation of blockbusters is going to like stick in the imagination the way a lot of the things that Spielberg and his generation created have done for us. But the other element is that all the things that Ready Player One is referencing came out of works that had a consistent aesthetic that suggested things about their world and created a mood and atmosphere. And slamming those things together on a screen, rather than evoking all those references all at once, actually seems to, at least judging by this trailer, seems to plunge everything into this aesthetic limbo of like self-reference. And it becomes like really dirge-like and joyless in some ways, right? Like, here we will visually recite all these memorable characters from works that you have an emotional reaction to, but this will evoke none of that reaction.
Right, well, that's the thing that is so tough about that is in the work itself, there's in the text, in the Ready Player One as a story is about someone who does not have those direct nostalgic connections to the works either, right? Like, it's about a boy who has studied those stories and films because the creator of this digital realm loved them so much, and he understands that, like, to unlock the key to find the Easter egg, basically I need to understand these things. And so he throws himself headfirst into the 80s culture and reveres it, you know, with an almost faith-like quality. And so even in the text, like, that nostalgia doesn't exist. It's why it feels just like a rapid shot of jabs of references, is because even for that character, that's really all those things are. They're detached. It's like going to like a bad 1920s theme party. You know what I mean? And everyone just calls you old sport. And it's like, that's not, and like they're wearing a monocle and like talking about the war, and like what are you talking about, you're just bullshitting me right now. Like,
last time I spent an evening at Roger Stone's house.
Rhonda Stone cosplaying the fucking optometrist from The Great Gatsby. Yeah. Great. Oh, my God.
Kieran Gillen said something, like, pretty great on Twitter this morning, sort of reacting to that trailer as well. He said that the book is both the book and especially this movie feel like they are like quietly adopting the kind of worldview that gave us Gamergate. And his point is that like the book's like underlying values, they sort of the way he says there's implicit gatekeeping in the work, implicit raising of a specific eternal canon from a set period, glorification of basic consumerist excess. And I think that's a pretty like to the point summary of like why this is an inherently problematic project in some ways, because it is like this dark Peter Pan for young men of a certain generation.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we increasingly kind of live in the tyranny of that of that worldview, it's become a lot less charming to sort of revel in it, right? Like, everything I need to know, I learned from 1980s action adventures. That's right. Incredibly fucked up.
I mean, that was like, we kind of talked about this either last week or the week before. We talked about this at some point. Yeah, we talked about
the Simon Pegg essay was...
Like, right, that's what it was. Right, totally. Well, and I think part of it that is interesting when you actually look at the text of Ready Player One is that it is about mastery and knowledge of trivia. It's about trivia ascending out of the trivial and to key working knowledge of the world around us. Because the world of Ready Player One, the digital world, has been remade in the image and logics of these worlds, of these 80s fictions. And so, you know, I think there is probably actually a deeply, like, cynical and pessimistic read of this whole work that is very in line with what Kieran said around Gamergate, but also just in a broader sense, the things that we used to think of as being, like, nerd culture and cut off are, in fact, increasingly mass market. And so it is something to be cautious about to kind of really praise that sort of knowledge of trivia as if it is like the hidden key, because it isn't. It is popcorn, and it's cool to be popcorn. I like it as popcorn a lot. Like, that's the thing that's fucked up, is I like all of the things they're referencing. I like almost all of them. I think
there's a fun way to do it, and it doesn't pull that off. And then there's another way, which is that you set up the premise of, like, it's a fun way, and then you actually end up criticizing the premise, like, in the execution of the story.
Yes, yes.
Like, I think that's more of the story that people wanted from Ready Player One. Again, I'm speaking this from an outside observer. It's like, okay, like, you can buy into this, like, sugary 80s pop premise, because, like, of course someone would make something this. Like, of course you could see reality mm-hmm. going down this path in a really shitty nihilistic way. But, like... instead of treating it as sort of like something to learn from, it seems to be mostly just celebrated in a masturbatory sort of fashion that, like, is not critical of, like, why that worldview is a problem or has issues or is something that we should be more deeply critical of.
Right, you want Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, right? You want Willy Wonka, which is like this world of sweetness and candy and delight reveals the dark nature of humanity and the ways in which we hate each other, and the way to move forward is love or something, right? You want that thing. And instead there is this like very cheesy notion of love at the core of Ready Player One that is not well executed, largely because I think the perspective character is so unbearable. But there is not that sort of like cutting at to the heart of what people think of as this digital world and why they like the things they like and why those references are there. Like, I know it's not that book. And I know there are people out there who are saying, like, you didn't even see the whole movie. You're just judging this about the trailer. I think it's a bad trailer. I'm allowed to judge the trailer as a trailer.
It is a bad trailer. And part of the reason I was holding out hope for the Spielberg adaptation, because I thought both in a grand sense of irony and also what it would have been interesting is if, like, Spielberg himself steps in to adapt a work that couldn't exist without his and says, actually, you don't understand the work that I made. And, like, did the adaptation as a way of, like, course correcting, like, the story in some fashion.
Right. But and who knows?
Maybe that is there. And the reason, like, they're doing the trailers this way is because the easy way to market this movie is to show all of those beats. And Spielberg has said that, And again, I don't know how much faith to put in this, that he gutted like a ton of the references to his own films, because he said that would have been distracting, and left in just a couple, right. because otherwise you'd be gutting too much of the work, like you'd be lying about what the work is. Yeah. But I guess in some, I still sort of hold out some sort of hope that maybe what Spielberg saw in that, and maybe he could find a way to make that more of like what that story probably should have been. But I... given Spielberg's track record with those types of movies in the last, like, 10, 15 years, like, I'm not super confident that'll happen.
Shia LaBeouf fucking swinging through the jungle with those monkeys. That was such... Swinging through the jungle.
How do you add aliens to Indiana Jones and then lose me? How do you add aliens to Indiana Jones and then lose me?
If anyone was here for the Indiana Jones aliens, it was you.
I was!
You were the Crystal Skull all along, Patrick, and... sad face on that skull. Should we talk about video games? Is that something we should talk about? Is there anything else in the world of snow and bad movies? No. Okay, video games. Good time. Okay, here's the thing that normally happens in December for me.
Yep.
I spend the first week of December going, oh fuck. There's no way I'm going to be able to play all the games I need to play before the end of the year. I can't write about everything. I have to be on podcasts. I have to talk about all the games. Ah, fuck. And then finally, like, the 8th hits, and I'm like, okay, I got to start playing these games. I can't just cry about it for a week. And so I then, like, start digging in. I start going through my Steam list. I start going through my backlog. I talk to everybody who I'm working with, and I go, hey, what's the thing that I missed that you want me to check out so we can talk about it on a podcast, or so that I can edit a piece for you, or blah, blah, blah. And... this year, normally what happens is that is what happens. I focus on that, and then I open up Twitter, and someone says, hey, your favorite game of the year just got some new DLC. You should go check that out. And I go, meh, no, bye. Like, I don't have the time. I'm too busy playing, whatever, Call of Duty, so I can at least talk about Call of Duty for 10 minutes on a podcast in 2 weeks or whatever. And so I end up not playing, going back to my own favorite games. But this year, two of my favorite games of the year, Breath of the Wild and PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, both got a big update. Zelda got the Champion's Ballad DLC, which is like the first story DLC. There's a lot of new shrines and challenges and kind of main world content. And then PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds got this desert map. And both of those things have me spending my time on games I already know I love, and I feel a little bit guilty, but also I kind of just needed to be in those places over the weekend. So I'm not apologizing.
No, but I understand your because I also, like, I wrote a post on my open thread last week was about, like, scrubbing through my list, trying to figure out what games to catch up on and trying to figure out which ones I could reasonably put time into, and found myself mostly going back to the games I'd already liked and just spending more time with them, and it is felt it's weird to say I have felt comfort in going back to a precision violent shooter but like there is comfort in, like, going back essentially like you and I, and we've been playing with Danica, going back and, like, getting to re-experience the arc that we had with Battlegrounds, in which everything feels new and mysterious and strange and deadly again. Not that we ever became masters at that game, but we achieved, like, the goal that we set out to do.
We won a chicken dinner live on stream, which we'd gotten individually, separately off stream, but not ever together on stream.
Yeah.
Like, in that character. Meant something. In character, exactly.
And so to be back doing that again, like especially given, like, separate from my role as a critic, just, like, this year, and just, like, the way, like, the exhaustion, like, both is, like, what it's exhausting to be a parent, and it's exhausting to be a parent in 2017 with all the other stuff going on. Like, there's comfort in going to things that just, like, feel comfortable and make you happy, and, like, going in and playing with my friends in Battlegrounds, like, is one of those things. And so, like, to have it executed so far so well, and to, like, add so much to an experience that I enjoyed so much throughout this year, like, is a cool, it's a good thing. Like,
it's so cool. So Rob, you have not played any Battlegrounds yet, right?
Right.
Have you watched much?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Have you seen any of this new desert map yet? because I need your tactical brilliance. You are on Team Waypoint. You are obviously the finest, most honed military mind we have to offer. And so I need you to help us understand what to do on this big open desert map.
Okay. So I guess my first question, because I haven't seen very much of it.
Yeah, we'll explain it.
Yeah. First of all, so, like, how big is it in terms of hexes?
Okay. I got an answer. I think it has the same number of hexes as the previous map. So it's the same basic hex count.
Okay. Okay, great.
So all those, the general ideas about the size of the circle changing and moving in, so all of that, all of our old talents should just map easily. So you don't have to worry about that. Don't even think about the hexes
at all.
So
why can't you just get inside the circle and go to Overwatch?
Okay. Well, we can. We can try that. Okay, it's a good question. Previously, what we would do to do that is we would go on to like a, we'd get a nice Overwatch position on a hill that's covered in foliage, right? Because you get just a cover
bushes,
bonus.
Bushes, man. Like, bushes. It's all about the bushes.
All about bushes, trees, rocks. Those are our big three. Trees, bushes, rocks. Say it with me. Trees, bushes, rocks. And now...
TBR.
And now... there are none of those things because we're in a desert. Oh, there are hills, and you can kind of find a crevice and get yourself into a crevice. But
yeah,
mostly...
there was a moment where Danica and Allison had a really, really good run after I managed to expose a trio of people hiding in a closet who then promptly shot me to death.
I threw a grenade in that closet and killed three
you
people.
Did.
It's
you
the
killed
only
three
time
people.
I've ever gotten a grenade kill in that game. So.
It was unbelievable. And so I was like trying to help them navigate the world after that. And there was, let's call it a crack that Austin could have rotated themselves into. And he was afraid of the crack.
I was afraid of the crack. Listen, I'm an 80s baby. You know, I'll stay away from the
afraid
crack.
Of the crack.
You know? God. The distances are far. Like, so that's the biggest change, I'd say, Rob.
You see people all, like, whereas in the previous map, like, yes, you saw people, but there was so much to hide behind, so much foliage, so many trees, so many
buildings. Your sight lines
broke
constantly. Like, you might catch somebody, but then they'd be gone because they'd be in the woods. And here it's like, oh, no, they're running across the desert, but they're too far away for me to do anything about. Like,
but you'll just see people. You look to your left, you'll see someone. You'll look to your right, you'll see someone. And you're constantly highly elevated in the map. And so you just are aware spatially of people all the time, and they're just... Whereas in the previous map, there's a lot of occasionally it's a risk that you have to go to an open field because you fucked up and you never found a vehicle or whatever the case may be. Whereas in this map, you're always running through open fields, like and not even fields. There's nowhere like you couldn't like lean down and hide. Like you would just be on the desert ground.
Yes. Or the other thing that happens here that's different is. The cities are actually cities. They're dense. They have like four or five, you know, story buildings that have big office layouts and stuff. And so those areas are dense. They have little taquerias, little office complexes, little homes and stuff, apartment buildings. I found a bunch of stuff. I mentioned to Patrick on the stream today. I don't want to say too much about some of the stuff I found because I want it to all be fresh as we do it. But like, for him as he plays, for Danica as she plays. But I found a casino, which was really cool. And it's just like, oh, I'm just in a casino now. And those areas are dense and urban in a way that the bulk of the first map aren't. And so there's this hard jump between super long range. Mm-hmm. You're not safe. You can't see or you're super visible. Everyone is super visible. And then these hyper dense like areas of heat and activity inside of these city spaces. And it's hard to know how to pivot between those two. Rob, we need your guidance. How do you go between dense urban combat and big open, like, long-range encounters?
That's a very tricky problem. And there are no good answers as far as it, like, because if you're switching, like, drastically between engagement ranges and scenarios and, like, terrain, then what you really need are two different weapons kits.
Right.
And I don't know if this game is going to afford you the luxury of that very often. Like,
yeah, that's the thing, is like So normally on the first map, the Orangel or whatever, the Orangel, the kind of forested, vaguely Eastern European themed map, I was always comfortable with, as long as I had a rifle, I was happy. Like, as long as I had a rifle, like a SCAR or an M16 or something, an AK, I was happy because that was kind of an all-distances weapon. It wasn't great for close-up. It wasn't as good as a sniper rifle for far ranges, but the bulk of encounters were in this medium range where a rifle served me right. And then what I basically would always do is say, okay, well, then I'll also take a submachine gun or a shotgun for close range, or I'll find a sniper rifle for really far ranges. And so I would have a kind of like... It felt like there was if you imagine a spectrum of encounters, I would have most of those encounters covered by any two weapons as long as one of them was a rifle. Here, it feels like that SMG or shotgun is so much more necessary in the close quarters of these cities because you're indoors so often. And then the sniper rifles are like so much more useful, especially if you get like a nice, like an 8X or a 15X scope, where it's just like not just useful, but really changes the feel of the map because you can. I mean, I said this months ago on this podcast, and I mean it so much more with the second map. Like, you can really, it feels like cheating. You can reach out and touch someone who can barely make you out on the horizon in a way that was not the case as often on Orangel, because Miramar, the second map, is just so flat and open with these desert spaces. It's not flat. There are mountains and stuff, but
really interesting hearing someone encounter this problem in a game where they've become really adept at like handling one tactical reality.
Right. Yes.
Because what this reminds me of actually is so the standard infantry rifle in the U.S. Army is like versions of the M16, right? Or it's descended the M4 carbine version of it. But that was all designed for what we anticipated the Cold War battlefields would look like—a mix of urban and like moderately open terrain. But like really, like you weren't going to have these massive like long distance ranges. It was going to be about intermediate ranges and then close quarters battle, and fire rate and control was going to be the main thing. And what's funny is like in Afghanistan, one of the problems that started to crop up there is that engagement ranges there just exploded. Right. Like, you had people firing across valleys at each other, and the rounds are that the M16s fire are too light to like fly reliably. And so like to this day in Afghanistan, people are using British Enfield rifles from the early 1900s.
Jesus.
Like, I don't know how to, like, there are enough anecdotal reports that has definitely happened in Afghanistan of late. I don't know how widespread it is.
Right.
But it's something people definitely felt this pressure to do of, okay, like, modern weapons are all designed for a different kind of war. And this century-old bolt-action rifle that fires this massive round is actually the best infantry weapon you can get on this battlefield.
Wow.
So I don't know, like it's a tricky problem. And I think my advice would be to pick one of those ecosystems and try to avoid the other one as long as possible.
That's not going to work in the long run. Unfortunately, I think it's going to be, and we're going to have to flip between both of them. Once that game drops, that game's out on the 20th. And my suspicion is it'll just be a hopper that lets you pull from both maps, you know? I also just briefly want to say that I think it's just a good map. Like, I think just as a game design thing,
it's really strong, and it forces you to play differently, which I think is like the highest possible. We were talking about this when we on the stream, but just the fact that for a game this popular, which has sold what 25 million copies, you know, like in it's unbelievable, and that's, I think it's going to do extremely well on Xbox. It'll do extremely well on PlayStation. Like, this game is going to be around for a decade. Like, I think it's going to be a Counter-Strike level success, and it's going to have a long life in esports and competitive play as it kind of like finds its footing once it goes 1.0. But it's so easy to have imagined this game already having 5 or 6 maps that felt remarkably similar, but with like a little bit different, but like generally took the first map and just kind of did some small stuff to it. But what they did was like fundamentally think about, how do people play the game, and how do we present them with something that flips all of, like, where it brings out, like, your ability to shoot a gun, still important. Your ability to, like, manage those things is still applicable, but it feels fresh and mysterious and scary, and yeah. you don't know how to approach it. And if that's the thinking and the care and the time that they're taking, it makes sense why this map took as long as it did. It feels like, I don't have insight into development. I don't know if, like, this map has secretly been, like, mostly done for 6 months, but... Right. outwardly presenting it, even if it has been done for that long, waiting this long, like, was a smart decision for how they're going to add yeah. and build on this game going forward. I like the fact that the map makes you play fundamentally differently, so that if, like, it'll end up making that first map feel refreshing by its very nature,
right.
because I won't be expelling the same sort of tactics and play and feedback loop in the second map from the first map. And, like, it just makes me excited for where they're going to take, like, it creates a confidence that they are going to do really, really interesting, cool things with
yep.
any other map. For, like, give me a snow map, motherfuckers. Like, give me the snow map. Like, yeah, I want it.
Absolutely.
And whenever they do that, I am sure it's going to play with the conventions of the game in a way that I can't expect. And, like, that's, like, one of the coolest things you can say about a persistent game is that I expect them to surprise me. And, like, I feel like maybe I have found, like, my forever game for a couple
right.
of years. And
right.
I've never had that before. And, like, that's cool to have found that.
Yeah, totally. I think a lot of people have dragged us a bit, Patrick, for being like, this is our first time really diving deep into a game, a single uh-huh. game that we uh-huh. return to. But, like, it is so cool not only to have that for us, but it's really great to see that team get better. Like, the UI has come such a far way from where it was when we first started playing. It does a much better job of calling out, like, the direction you're looking at the top of the screen, at communicating where the people on your own team are.
Oh, God, yeah.
The world feels designed instead of built. Like, instead of it just being like, okay, we made a world, it feels like, you bring up CSGO, you bring up Counter-Strike, and, when I was playing yesterday with friend of the site, Matt Pasquale, he noted that there's this one structure. We found it in our first stream. Those structures that were – there's like a mine. There's like a big industrial area right to the mm-hmm. to the east of the cemetery. And there's these big buildings that, like, kind of – they kind of, like, jackknife up into the air and then over huge structures that have all of these stairs going up them in interesting ways. They have there's like a hole blown out in, for some of them. There's a hole blown out of one of the sides of the walls and on, like, the second level floor. There's like another escape area that you can kind of come out on a third stairway down. And there's like one of the most interesting things is there's on the top floor there's just an escape hatch that drops down to the first floor. And the way that it moves around, Matt, you know, mentioned, like, oh, this feels like a CS:GO map. And it does, and, like, just that little bit, those little things. I think the same thing is true for a number of other things, where it's like, I've noticed there's a lot of roofs that have holes in them from so that if you land on top of them, you then have the opportunity to just jump down into the building. Or if you wind up there because you've vaulted up there, you know, via some boxes or something, there's this other line of attack. There's, like, all of these new, better that close range fighting has gotten so much more interesting because of the map, the building design on top of the broader macro map design. And it's also just gotten more interesting. Like, I feel like there's an apology in this map. One of the things that I don't like about the first map is one of my biggest beefs is that there's a plane crash and it's the most boring thing in the world. You can find this crashed plane and there's, like, nothing
we've
there.
We've gone back to that, like, section yes. like on various updates thinking they got to add something to this.
They got to add something to this. They got to be maybe at least, like, a cool gun, and maybe there's going to be, like, a helmet. Like, no, there's never anything. It's just a crashed plane in the woods, which, like, on the, you know, when this game first came out, that's a neat little bit of flavor, sure. This time there's another plane crash, and the plane has crashed into this, like, little, like, village that runs north-south, and it's just torn the village apart, and the debris is scattered everywhere. The buildings are in shambles. There's, like, loot spread all throughout it. It feels like a plane crash, and, like, getting into a fight in that place feels dangerous in a weird way because everything's on fire, everything is, like, torn apart, there's rubble everywhere, and, like, that alone feels like they're not just making interesting spaces to fight in, but are making, like, they're not just making spaces that encourage good gunplay or, you know, the sort of gunplay that feels intense. They're also kind of turning up the notch on flavor, on communicating something about a place, giving all of the little zones a placeness. And if they continue doing that, like I like you, we'll keep coming back to this game pretty much indefinitely, you know? So
yeah,
that
so this is being like a designer being like, let's put in a crash plane because it's cool. And then Let's put in a crash plane because we want to, it says something about the fight that you're about to engage in.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, I'm pretty all in. Rob, do you think you're going to hop in now that it's coming to Xbox?
Look, if I'm going to play this thing, it's going to be on PC.
Okay.
It's more just that, like, you know, it's like any competitive game. It feels like from what you guys have gotten out of it, having invested what you've invested, like I'm not, you know what I mean? It, like if I'm going to buy that ticket, I'm going all the way.
You got to go all the way. Yeah, I got you. Listen, we have.
And I got a lot of 2008 games to finish.
That's true.
I hope one thing that people take away from this is that I do think the onboarding into Battlegrounds, especially if you play with folks that know what you're doing, you can have a really good time even as you're coming to grips with the mechanics of the game. Like Danica didn't know what the fuck she was doing when she started playing with us, and she doesn't even play a ton of shooters. And now, like, she regularly. Hang.
She takes the lead. She'll run off. She'll be very aggressive. She's rad. Like, I love playing with Danica because she's, like, not afraid to take chances.
she does the things that, like, we won't do that work out some of the time and some of the time don't work out. But it's fun to have, like, she's our wild card. And, like,
yeah, I love it.
It's really, it's so like, she actually pushes us to do more interesting things, even if sometimes they're in response to the decisions that she makes, because like Austin, like when you played a lot, you become ingrained in your habits.
Yep,
and
totally.
Like, that worked for me last time. And it's like, it's nice to have someone be like, nah, fuck it. I'm just running in with my pistol.
It's
like, all right, let's go get him.
The right choice sometimes. Right. Like you want someone with an itchy trigger finger sometimes, you know, otherwise you just sit in the house.
I will say, it's not like Danica's coming in completely cold, because as part of her job, she watches you guys fuck up a lot. and so, like, she has had a pretty advanced tutorial in what works and what does not and what generates hilarity in Battlegrounds. She has been, you know, those gifts don't clip themselves.
That's, you know, you're right. She studied from the best. And now the students become the teacher. You're right. No, you're right. You're right.
That was a little mean, Rob. Yeah. Maybe you should go read Ready Player One.
Then you'll learn what it's like to be a real gamer, and then you can come play with us.
Go get a six-pack of Mountain Dew and read some Ready Player One.
You guys reliably know what the crouch key is now, right?
It depends. It depends.
Depends on the day.
Well, the thing...
I mean, Austin, like, today accidentally threw a grenade when he didn't mean to, so...
Is that true?
But then made up for it by throwing a grenade when you did mean to.
I did mean to. The second time. Yes, that's true. You're right. The first thing that I did today was I threw a grenade. I threw a smoke grenade in a room. I was like, ah, fuck. I'm just waking up. This isn't great.
Okay, I have a very important question, because I've been watching some game footage while you guys have been talking.
Yeah.
How do I get that sweet black leather trench coat?
Take it from someone's dead body. That's how you get it. Or you buy a crate.
Damn it. God damn it.
The loot had been pretty good.
Gabriel Knight goes to war.
All of the armor in this game is ridiculous, and I love it. The main game has like a reward crate system. As you play, you get, you know, whatever bullet point bucks or whatever, and spend those. They're called BP, right? What's that? Battleground points, I guess.
Bullet bucks are better though.
Bullet bucks, you know, and you spend your bullet bucks on a new hat or whatever. You get a crate and you open the crate and goes, it's a hat. And you go, I'll wear this hat until I find a helmet, I guess. That's why you want to get a coat, because you wear the coat the whole game. it's, or you can just find it. You can find gear just in the wild, basically. It's good. We got to get you playing, Rob. We do. Once you get through all your 2008 games, what's the 2008 game that you're playing today?
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Well, okay, it's not quite that bad. I haven't climbed into the Wayback Machine quite that drastically, but I'm just playing a little Dead Rising 3.
Okay, that's 2013. That's good.
Yeah,
that's
close. I'm catching up. I'm catching up to you guys.
Not four. Not the Christmas one. We're going towards the holidays. I thought maybe oh, Dead Rising holidays. That's like a good. No.
No. No.
That's Dead coming Rising out on 3. PS4 soon. Dead Rising 3.
That's the Dead Rising 3 is a good game. It was a genuine, like, you know, the Xbox One had what? Rise? What was that game called? Rise. And Dead Rising 3.
It was Sunset Overdrive wasn't even out, right?
Oh, yeah, Sunset Overdrive was around.
No, I think
that,
it
like...
took a little bit, though. I think it was.
Well,
like...
okay, those first
yeah,
six months.
Yeah, but it was in that launch window.
And I like Sunset Overdrive a lot. Where's my sequel? Dead Rising 3 is good.
Yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised by it. Because I've never played the Dead Rising games because I've never
probably that probably explains part of why you like this one, because the backlash to 3 was partially rooted in the changes it made relative to the first two games.
Right, because you don't drink any orange juice in this one, do you? You don't have to manage.
I don't know. You pretty much hoover up food whenever you can, right?
Okay, like, but you're not monitoring a weird hunger meter.
No.
There's no clock? Is there a clock?
Nope.
Not really. No.
Is there Otis? Is Otis there? Is Otis helping you out? My boy Otis. No?
Not really.
Otis in the first game. He's like the guy who's like on the radio who's telling you where to go.
Oh, I mean, I've sort of got a guy like that. He calls me on the phone and I can't talk back to him, and he's it's like basically if it were a movie, he'd definitely be a John Goodman character.
Okay. That's cool.
Maybe helpful, but maybe will also try and murder you at some point. Who can really say? But I think that mostly what's sort of taking me aback by this, and I kind of dig it, is there's just a lot of zombies in this game. Like, tons. Like, more than you would really think feasible to put on the screen and, like, mob you with. And there's an element of just, like, at a certain... It's not like a brilliant or original idea this game has. It's literally, like, what if lots of zombies?
Yeah.
But, you know, you think you've played games that have lots of zombies.
No, and then, Dead Rising like, 3 has Dead a Rising. Lot of zombies, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm kind of like, and there are moments that there's sort of a breathtaking menace to it, right? Like moments where you're looking down over a congested section of fake Los Angeles freeway, and it's just like a moving carpet of zombies, and then they notice you and start to like shamble towards you, and you got to somehow like figure out how you're going to get through this herd. Basically,
how do you get through?
Well,
how did you get through? Not like a general sense.
It depends. Sometimes I have a car, but the cars get, you know, they're pretty good for slicing through crowds of zombies, but they also start to take damage and catch on fire. And usually you have to bail out of the car at the worst possible moment. And that gets pretty hairy.
This sounds a lot like Battlegrounds to me, actually. This is very similar.
the thing that Dead Rising 3 is doing as well is... A lot of it, and this I have mixed feelings about, a lot of it hinges on weapon combos.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just that, like, oh, cool, you found a katana somewhere, and now that's your zombie-killing, like, ace weapon. The katana's going to get used up probably in, like, 5 minutes. What your real game plan is to combine, like, a weed whacker and a broom or something like that.
Sure,
you got a weed
course.
Whacker on a broom, and... You clear just start
advantage.
Like, yeah, it, look, it doesn't seem super practical. Like, you know, it doesn't seem like the broom handle would really be able to sustain even the motion of the weed whacker, but whatever, it's fine. But basically, you can go, like, just carving through herds of zombies with these sort of, like, power weapons. And a lot of the game seems to be about just setting you up to turn into, like, a human threshing machine through zombies, which is cool, but... Also, I think it is contributing to this feeling of the game feeling a little bit weightless. These crowds are huge, and that's
right,
cool.
Right.
But then you're also like slicing and dicing your way through zombies so quickly and in such like ridiculous numbers that in no time at all, it just starts to feel like you're character is really just more of like a sprinkler head that you attach a different weapon to and then move around.
Okay, but there's still a lot of zombies, which, you know.
There's a lot of zombies.
I have such a weird, I guess, relationship with those games, because the first Dead Rising was definitely one of the things that sold me on the Xbox 360. Like, I had an Xbox 360, but like, definitely had had that feeling, like, oh, was this worth the money? And then Dead Rising 1 hit, and it was such a unique experience that felt next gen in the way that we talk about next gen. Like, it felt like, okay, the PS2 could not do this. The Xbox could not have done this thing. And it was original in so many weird gameplay ways. Like, I talked briefly, Rob, about how there was a clock. The first Dead Rising, I think the second one too, there was just like, the world was the world and things were happening all the time. And so if you wanted to go save, you know, Jim and Rick at the sporting goods store, you had to do it while you get a call that says that they're there and that they need help and that you have to go out and help them. And hey, if you encounter one of the bosses in the open world on the way, like, you better either run from that boss or deal with them quick so that you can go save Jim and Rick. Because if you don't, Jim and Rick are dead. And it was really cool to have to manage all of that stuff, especially when I was, like, in college and had a lot of time on my hands. So having an imperfect run through was not a problem. I would just load a save or, like, start a new game. And actually, like, now I know how the map is laid out. I know where all the cool weapons are. And so it was such a unique game that I, you know, when I saw that they pulled all that stuff out of 3, I definitely had the unfortunate and, like, you know, it's not a response that I'd like to have, of just like, oh, this isn't what I want, this isn't my thing. And so I also never got around to it, because I didn't have an Xbox One until this year, so it just was never on the radar for me.
Really. Dead Rising 3 is on PC okay. now, and it'd be worth, like, I haven't played 4, but even from folks that enjoyed 3, I think it sounds like 3 is maybe the stronger game. I bounced off Dead Rising 1, like, hard. Like, I wasn't one of the people who was like, you gotta change this game in order to make it better. It just, like, didn't, despite the fact that, like, a lot of it sounded like my thing. I don't know. Like, it just didn't click. But, like, if I went back and played that game now, my guess is I would like it a lot more because of what's changed about what I appreciate about games. Like, the kinds of games I like are much more like what Dead Rising was doing now, as opposed to what I liked out of games then. And so because Dead Rising 1 and the way it handled, like, punishment and consequence and time management was so, like, again, like, this was the beginning of, like, games like Gears of War that did, like, a lot of hand-holding to make sure you got through things. That's not a specific indictment of Gears of War as much as, like, games are expensive and they want to make sure you see all the shit that they're doing. And I felt like I couldn't appreciate Dead Rising. I didn't know that at the time, but my guess is if that game was presented to me now and, like, a, like, Dead Rising didn't exist, and then they made Dead Rising, I'd end up really, really liking that game.
It has issues, to be clear. Like, I don't think it's a perfect game or anything, but I think it's super. I think that, like, it does so many unique things that are that make it stand out in a crowd. And so definitely worth looking at some point.
I'm finding striking about it. Also, just having played Binary Domain in this year, there is a weirdly consistent absurdity in Capcom games that I find, like, it's weird. I'm sure these are from different teams and everything, but there's, like, a consistent sensibility across these games. Like, the fact that Dead Rising is sort of backdropped by this ridiculous, like, attempt to contain a plague using Zombrex chips.
Right, you gotta use, of course. See, if you know the whole backstory, Zombrex has a whole history, you know, of there are mosquitoes. He has a daughter. He has a daughter, and she needs her Zombrex. There's a whole thing. The fiction of Dead Rising is fantastic all the way through. Like, it is very goofy and campy.
So you should go back and play 1.
2 is the one with is Chuck. Chuck is his name. Did you play 2, Patrick, or did you also not play 2?
No, I skipped 2.
Okay. In 1, you play as Frank West, who is a photojournalist. In 2, you play as Chuck. I keep wanting to say Taylor. It's not Chuck Taylor. It's Chuck Green. And Chuck Green is, like, a reality, like, there's this, like, a stunt TV show performer, like, in which he, it's like Rollerball, or, like, it's like it's one of those but with zombies. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like a zombie like action sports show, and he uses the prize money to buy Zombrex to give to his daughter, who otherwise would turn into a zombie. And so then everything goes bad. He's in Vegas. It's in Vegas. The games have like such great settings. And so again, it's really campy and absurd. And I'm glad to hear that 3 also sticks that landing.
So far at least, but yeah. It's been fun.
Also, to something you were mentioning, Rob, the post Dead Rising 2, 3, and 4 were all made by Capcom Vancouver. The first one was made in Japan, and then it was handed off to a sort of a Dead Rising specific studio.
Also, that. I'm pretty sure Binary Domain was Sega because it's the same as the Yakuza team. So Sega, okay. Still Japanese team. And the first Dead Rising was Japanese, I think.
Yes.
Because I remember hearing a lot of people at the time talk about that game as being Japan trying to do an American style game, which was interesting to think about, I guess. All right, cool. We'll keep checking in on Rob's zombie minute. Every week, Rob will go back and play a different Dead Rising 3, a zombie, you, and...
Well, we forced him off zombie you because we're all going to play that.
And what's the space one?
Dead Space.
The space one.
Lost Planet is the sci-fi Capcom.
Yes.
Okay.
Cool.
I'll play that one next.
Oh my god! Don't play. That first Lost Planet was okay at the time.
Yeah.
If you've gone back,
I've also heard Lost Planet 3 has like a surprisingly good story.
Really? Uh-huh. Huh. 3 was the one that was from
a Western studio.
The Western studio, right? Huh. I'm curious about it. They have mechs. Those games have mechs. I like their designs a lot. They have cool monsters. 2 was a game I really, really, really wanted to like. I kept telling myself if I ever got to play co-op, I would like it because it was clearly designed as sort of like sci-fi linear monster hunter. Like these big fights, and it just didn't ever really click for me.
I just love how easy it is to bait Austin. Like literally, you just put a robot underneath a box held up with a stick and like put a note on the robot that says it has feelings.
Well, as long as that robot doesn't say ready, or the note doesn't say Ready Player One, because then I'll just turn me away. Like there is a degree of it, like I need you to be genuinely interested in making a game about robots. Like that's what it comes down to. It can't be, I know I'm going to get people who like robots by making a game about robots. I need the person making the fucking robot to care more about those robots than I ever will. And that will by itself create a robot that makes me care about it. You know, like, does that? No,
okay. That makes an intense amount of sense for somebody who's completely off the cuff. And it's a little concerning.
I've thought about this a lot. Listen, I it's weird. Like I actually, my love of mechs is a weird thing because I get a lot of fans who are like, oh, did you see that Japan and America are going to have a giant robot fight? And like, I could want nothing less than that. Like that is the opposite of why I like all of my favorite mech shit is about how war is terrible and how like mechs are interesting because they are this intense like fetishization of technology passed directly through the ego of mankind who's decided that tanks aren't good enough for them. And so what they really need is tanks that look like people. And like, I think those tanks look cool as hell. Like that's the, like, I also think that the giant robots look dope. But those stories fundamentally are again and again and again are about how terrible war is, were the ones that really resonate with me. And so, like, it does take more than just a cool design to hit me, unless it's a really cool design, in which case it's just I like robots. But it's rare that I get into a piece of media because I think the robot design looks cool. I need to know, like, what is the setting? Like, what are the characters? What's going on in the story? And then also it helps if the robots are really dope. So that's my robot minute. We've had Rob's zombie minute. We've had my robot minute. Patrick, do you have a minute? Do you have a check-in? Is there anything you've been like, what's the through line in your life besides like your family and your dog?
it's like a horror minute. I guess I watch like probably a horror movie once every week or 2 weeks, but I don't think I've watched one. I'm trying to think of what we watched lately. Well, I haven't watched one lately because part of the union that we're a part of at Vice means that I get these Writers Guild screeners, and so I've been watching like real movies as not my garbage horror films every week. I watched Last Flag Standing. It was pretty good.
What's that?
It's with Bryan Cranston and Lawrence Fishburne and Steve Carell. Steve Carell's son dies in Iraq or Afghanistan, and then goes to pick up his body. It is way less sad than the premise of Midnight Sound. It's a very funny and touching movie. It was written and directed by, I never know how to pronounce this guy's name, Richard Linklater?
Linklater. Is how I've always said it, yeah.
Yeah. So that's good. That's cool. My movie minute. There you go.
Your movie minute. There we go. Movie minute. Now we know. I'll take that. This is what we all do in our spare time. It's great. I guess, you know what? I did a weird anime update a couple weeks ago. So you know, we're all in our zones right now. I think it's going to do it for us. I have to go into the office for a meeting, and I told the people that I would be. It's like one of those meetings. You ever have one of those meetings where it's like, oh, I'll be in the office from this time to this time, and we'll figure out a time once you're there. And that's, like, not a good way to do meetings because then no one's ever actually there at the right time.
That's how you do a meeting at the very end of the day when everyone really wants to go home.
Exactly. Well, it is 2:30 and I still have to do the whole commute into the office and also eat a sandwich somewhere in here. So I'm going to say that this is going to be the end of our show for now. Mm-hmm. It's the second week in a row that I just have not eaten anything before we did a podcast. And it's a mistake. I want to put it out there. It's a mistake to do that.
You got to do what I do. You got to think about lunch in the morning so right. that – you can have it sort of like prepped and set aside. So when you've got that 10 minutes,
I just can vacuum just in that sandwich in your mouth. Yeah. Right. Gotcha.
Or as I think as Rob put it, hoovering it into your mouth.
Yeah. Perfect.
Waypoint Radio. Hopefully there's a Hoover ad.
Ah, fuck. We didn't take an ad break again.
No.
God damn it.
Well, don't worry.
Don't worry. There'll be one anyway.
We took one last week and I. Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. I hope everyone enjoyed. I hope everyone for the better part of 24 hours really enjoyed. It was good.
It was the better part of like 48 hours. There was a point where you told me it was fucked. Or someone on Twitter showed us that it was bad. And I was like, okay, let me hear how bad this is. Like, oh, that's a real funny place to put that ad. I'm going to leave it there. So we didn't intend for it to go there, but we did intend to leave it there for as long as we did. I fixed it yesterday, like last night, I think, finally. So this morning, someone told me they heard it where it was. So they probably had already downloaded it.
Yeah, it doesn't replace the file. You have to delete it and then pull it again from the... But you... If you have the original, you have the canonically
that's
real
the canonical
version.
One. Yeah. So yeah, there will be an ad in there somewhere. In any case, I'm Austin Walker. You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Patrick?
Find me at Patrick Klupik.
And Rob.
You can find me at Rob Zachney on Twitter.
Awesome. As always, you can follow Waypoint on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, waypoint.vice.com for all of our stories. Also, our forums, discourse.zone. And as always, thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. I hope everyone has a warm week, but not like a too warm week. Hopefully not like a like fucking shout out to everyone in LA, and I hope the fire situation there is contained and taken care of. I haven't heard an update today about it. But
if you're in Alabama, go vote.
Also, yeah, if you're in Alabama, go vote. Go vote. For me, I would vote for the person who is an alleged pedophile. But you know, go vote. Leave your voting conscience up to you.
It's between you and your conscience.
It's between you and you. You know, it's not my job to tell you who to go vote for. But I will openly say who I would vote for. So, fuck. This country is in a place, y'all. We're going to get through it. A couple more weeks in 2017, and we'll put 2017 behind us. And we'll have a whole other year. We'll have a whole nother year to compare to the year before and see, is this one better or worse?
Should I watch Legend of the Galactic Heroes?
Yes, oh my god, yes, Rob. Rob?
Yes.
Rob. Yes.
That Rob,
made
up.
We're going to hang
that
up this phone. We're going to hang up this call, and then you and I are going to talk about Legends of the Galactic Heroes and why we should watch that show together.
Are there robots in it?
No, but there's incredible spaceships. There are some robots
I'm all
in
about
it.
Spaceships. But there are, I actually like spaceships more than robots.
Dude, then the spaceships in this show are incredible and are like... The whole thing is this military space opera that is interested in it in terms of military history, and it's great. It's great. It's an incredibly you show. My phone is ringing. I'm going to hang up this call. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We're done.
Be good at peace.
Bye.